Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is an award-winning author and New York Times bestseller. Mary Roach has made a name for herself using her curiosity to explore the science behind sex, space, afterlife, and human cadavers. Her new book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. It explores everything from soldiers' uniforms to the Navy's research into shark repellent. It's a fascinating look at the science used in helping keep soldiers alive. Mary Roach is in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival, and she joins me in studio. Mary Roach, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Hey, great to meet you.
This is a great book. I was riveted from cover to cover on the concept of like just getting to understand all the science at its play when it comes to war. You say early in the book, this is not really about killing. It's really about keeping things alive.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Exactly. You think of military science, you think of bombs, guns, strategy,
all
of that. That doesn't interest. The Discovery Channel does a really fine job with the big things that blow up and kill people, and that's not my bag. So I'm like the white hat side of it. So I'm looking at, listen, I like all the science that goes into the, I like the day-to-day grind of being a soldier, like extreme heat and flies and loud noise and sleep deprivation and stress. And also sort of the putting people back together if they step on a bomb, that kind of thing. So not the kind of military science people typically think of.
I mean, you've made, and we'll talk about this in the interview, but you've made a career off of using your curiosity as a guide when it comes to some of these big ticket items, whether it be sex or space or war. What was it about war that attracted you? What was the idea of taking that concept and
this idea came to me in kind of an unusual way. I was reporting in India on the world's hottest chili pepper, Bhut Jolokia, where this is in this remote part of India. They have this chili pepper eating contest where people eat like 10 or a dozen of these, and they get taken away in an ambulance. It's a really crazy scene. Anyway, while I was there, someone said, hey, did you know the Indian Defense Ministry made a bomb out of this, like an exploding chili pepper powder, non-lethal thing, you know, to clear the room, sort of pepper spray, but sustainably locally grown with local
organically grown. Right.
So I thought, well, it sounds like I should include that. So I went to this lab that the Indian Defense Ministry has, and they're doing, you know, they have the pepper spray, which didn't work out because it's prone to mildew. So they never used that, but they were working on a leech repellent. That's just like a Mary Roach thing. I'm like, no, really? How do you test a leech repellent? Well, we're going down to the river and rolling up our trousers, putting on the leech. I'm like, oh, this, I don't know. Just because I think of war like most people, I think of war stories and heroism and combat and you know, big ticket items like that and PTSD, which is I don't cover because it's kind of a whole book unto itself. But there's all these kind of esoteric challenges of like flies on the battlefield and noise, which is obviously things are loud, but the challenge being if you give somebody earplugs now, they lose their situational awareness. So like all these like kind of like things that I hadn't really thought about.
And that's also the power of the book, is it's a lot of things you don't think about when it comes to war. One of which, I mean, just to give examples, early on you talk about the idea of zippers and snipers, you know, that the zippers don't really work if you are in a position where you have to crawl around and move around. Talk about that.
Yeah, right. I was at Natick Labs as this design studio, that right there. Fashion designers at this military lab. Anyway, this woman who's a beautiful woman who's a fashion designer, she's showing me, you know, it's like a dress form that they have in design studios, and she's showing me this top, and it's a sniper top. I love that she called it a top. This is our base sniper top. And so I was like, wow, that's really sleek. It's very clean. And I was sort of complimenting her design. She said, well, that's because it's a side closure, and that's functional, because if you're a sniper, you're somebody, you may be lying on your belly for 8 hours, and if you have a zipper, first of all, it's uncomfortable, and also dirt, sand will get ground into the little teeth, and then they don't work anymore. So she made it a side closure, and then she put the pockets on the sleeves rather than on the chest, because you're lying on your chest. Who thinks about this stuff? The woman in the design studio at Natick Labs.
The Natick Labs plays a big role in the book, but also, I mean, the concept of the uniform. There's a lot of factors that go into you know, what goes into a uniform for a soldier. One of which I was really interested in was about the underwear. You know, there was at first, because born out of the idea of a protective gear, almost like a bulletproof underwear, if you will. But it turned out that silk underwear is where they landed. Let's talk about this.
Yeah. There's this company that was kind of, you know, the language, this is bomb-proof underwear.
That's what it was,
which to me, right. I was like, come on. You can blow up a tank. You can certainly blow up a pair of underwear. What they meant, it's not bomb-proof, but what it is, if an IED goes off, IEDs are buried explosives. So what they're doing, if you're down, you know, if you're a few feet away, you might not lose limbs, but this sand and dirt, you basically get sandblasted. And that's bad enough, but the sand and dirt carries all this bacteria. And it just, those little tiny projectiles of sand and dirt get jammed into your leg or whatever, wherever, you know, mm-hmm. wherever the impact is. So you get these horrible infections and these recurring infections. So if you have something like there are Kevlar underwear, but Kevlar, people don't realize Kevlar, you need like 15, 20, even 40 plies to be bulletproof.
So it's not good for a soldier who has to move. And,
it's not good underwear. You just have a comfortable underwear item. What does work is silk. Silk is very, very strong by weight. It's one of the strongest textiles, fabrics. And it's also natural, comfortable, breathable. So it's just funny. The military is like, rejecting some of the high tech and embracing natural fibers.
And you know, the idea that, you know, if there, God forbid, there is a wound in some form, silk is not the kind of fabric that, like a cotton, that's going to get inside the wound and things like
that. That's right. Silk doesn't break up and fragment the way cotton does. It's such a great substance that the Natick for a while in the basement they had. The spider room, this room full of spiders, because they were trying to basically do recombinant spider silk. They figure out the protein sequence and synthesize it so that they don't have to. Well, you can't really spider silk. You can't, like, unlike silkworm silk, where you can kind of farm it. You can have silkworms kind of doing their thing. That's, you can't with spider silk. So they're trying to figure out a way. So they had the spider room. I love that.
Mary Roach is my guest in studio. Her new book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Explores everything from what we're talking about, soldiers' uniform, undergarments, I want to talk about this coming up, the Navy's research project into shark repellent, which is it's just fascinating the way that plays out. Mary Roach in studio at the big table tonight. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Mary Roach, the award-winning New York Times bestselling author. Her new book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And she's in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. She took some time out to talk to us tonight. I mean, there's so much that goes into this, and we've almost glorified the idea of science around war to weapons with James Bond. Oh, I've got this new weapon. I've got this new high-tech thing that's going to make you kill your enemy. And we don't think at all about the fact that science plays such a major role in just keeping soldiers alive. I mean, everything – I mean, I have on the list here, I mean, just like bullet points from the book, but zippers, silk underwear – adaptation plays a big role. The idea of the Army being able to take a tank that they use in Afghanistan and be able to use it in Iraq and have to re-outfit these because the climate, the terrain, the environment, mm-hmm. everything's different.
Yeah. No, it's been this ongoing challenge, the fact that a country goes to war with the stuff that they had for the last war. So, you know, if your last war was in tropical, you know, say Vietnam sort of situation. Now you're going to go. You're going to go into the Middle East,
the desert.
The desert, right? So now you need things that'll keep you alive in extreme heat, and it's dry, and the bugs are different. You know, and you spend all this money on like tents and uniforms that would resist mildew. Okay,
right.
And now, like, great, we've got these mildew resistant uniforms that are really, really hot, and people are getting heat stroke. So you have, and with the vehicles, they were going into, you know, from Eastern Europe last conflict, and then into the Middle East with Humvees, and they start getting hit with RPGs, and they were not holding up, and it was bad. I mean, you had soldiers like just getting like tin, like garbage cans and whatever, and just trying to up armor. I love that verb, up armor.
Up armor.
Trying
to
up armor on their own because, you know, you had to come up with a new vehicle ultimately. But then How? What do you do when you? And also, RPGs, they figured out it was pretty cool. You could just do slat armor, which is just putting like a fencing on the side.
Right.
Lightweight, so you're not going to put on too much weight so the engine can't, because that's a problem. If you just throw a lot of armor on, now the engine and the brakes are beyond what they can deal with. But so slat armor is like the RPG would come in and it was like, fonk, stuck in the little slat. Mm-hmm. So they would come back to the base like with, you know, bristles of like porcupines. So that, you know, that's a good idea and cheap and easy. But then the insurgents started burying bombs first on the side of the road. So they had to up armor the side and then
underneath.
And then underneath. Right. And now underneath. That had been bigger and bigger right in the roadway. And they had the seats bolted to the bottom. So now you got this force slamming up and you're sitting in a chair that's bolted to that. It's slamming the fat pad on the heel would burst, the like lower limb injuries, pelvis, spine. So they had to figure out, you know, what kind of vehicle?
And they got to figure out quickly.
They got to figure it out quickly.
It's a major.
Yeah, exactly. And they can't figure it out quickly, and that's awful. And, you know, and that's so frustrating for everybody.
There is something about that. I mean, that isn't necessarily what the book's about, but that the Army puts a lot of money into science and research, not just for the weapons and high tech stuff, but for the science of keeping their soldiers alive.
Right.
But sometimes it takes trial and error, it takes cause and effect,
right.
It takes months to figure out. Hey, and these soldiers are dealing with some outdated materials and things that
exactly.
aren't going to work for the situation they're in.
Yeah, yeah, and with the vehicles, you know, you say, okay, we definitely need a new troop carrier, a personnel carrier that is mine resistant, that's going to withstand this. So you get these contractors bring, you know, they've got 10 prototypes. Ours is the best. Ours is the most protective. Well, how do you know? You're not going to just like put guys and women in it and say, here, see if that works for you. You have to test it. So how do you test that? Crash test dummy. Well, those are made for automotive crashes, which is a head on or like a T-bone crash at an intersection. And that's nothing like, because when the bomb goes off underneath you, floor smashing upward. So instead of, you know, the head going forward and it's completely different. So they're designing a whole new crash test dummy. I mean, that's a long process. You got to use cadavers to get a sort of different documenting what happens at this kind of force and this kind of force.
Yeah, I have written down here cadaver injury data, which is a big part of it. Yeah,
and it's so slow going. And then the horrible thing is that by the time they're done, who knows where we'll be and what the threat will be and what they'll be throwing.
That's going to be
us.
The problem, I think, with all of the science and everything that goes into it, is just keeping up. We've just seen from small wars moving from Afghanistan to Iraq. I mean, they're different terrains, and the Army has to pick
up. Exactly.
Mary Roach is my guest in studio. She's the author of Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. We've teased it out, the idea of the ears and sound. And when you think of battle zones or even in soldiers that have to shoot weapons, big weapons, they're loud. I mean, these are the kind of things where, I mean, if you don't have protection for your ears, you're talking about side effects, injuries, things that are happening to soldiers that were unintended.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just the M16, the rifle that's used, you fire that thing without any kind of protection, one shot can cause incremental damage because it's so loud. I mean, hearing loss happens, you know, it's not just how loud it is, but it's how loud it is and how long you're exposed. So say like 85 decibels, that's like a really loud, busy street. You got about 8 hours of that noise where you'll be okay. Mm-hmm. But something as loud as an M16 or an anti-tank weapon, a fraction of a second, that can cause
damage.
And
there's prolonged, exposure to this.
Yeah, I mean, I was down at Camp Pendleton with some military audiologists. There was the thing they were doing there. At one point, they had a bunch of special operations guys sitting talking to the audiologists. And one of the audiologists said, how many of you have significant hearing damage? Every hand went up. I mean, there's like two guys there in their 40s that have hearing aids. I mean, you're exposed to so much. And the problem, I mean, you can protect hearing, but when you do that, you lose your situational awareness, which is the big thing for a soldier. You're going to know, like, who's behind you? What are your fellow soldiers saying to
you? You need to use all your senses, right?
Yeah, somebody sneaking up behind, a car coming up behind you on the gravel. You're not going to hear that.
So how does the Army or the Marines, or how do they deal with this? I mean, is this something
they have a system called TCAPS, Tactical Communication Protection System. So it's like a headset with a mouthpiece built in that you can wirelessly talk to people around you. I tried one on. It's kind of amazing. It gives you like bionic hearing.
So it's almost like video games.
Yeah. It decreases the loud noises. It muffles those to the point where it's safe. But it can tell between a quiet sound and a loud sound. So a human voice, somebody talking, it amplifies that. At the same time, it dampens the loud noises. So you could be way across the room. You're too young, but there was this show, The Bionic Woman.
Sure.
And she had this bionic,
sure.
Dee, 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 dee. And she'd be listening in on some thugs across the street. I mean, you have that. I was like, whoa, I wanted it to be on public transit and just eavesdrop.
Right. That sounds like it could be in the wrong hands real quick. So
yeah.
That's good to know. But I mean, we'll continue. Let's take a break and get an update on tonight's news. But I really want to tell the story about shark repellent.
Yeah.
This is so interesting, and it happened in World War II or right around that time, trying to figure out a way to keep sharks away from Navy soldiers who may either get shot down, fall off a boat, whatever it might be.
Yep.
But there's a lot going on. Mary Roach is my guest tonight. She is the author of Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. She's in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, continue the conversation. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Mary Roach, the author of Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Mary has really made a name for herself using her curiosity to explore things like sex, space, human cadavers. Now it's war. I've been teasing this out the whole hour, this idea of shark repellent. This story really stuck with me. Let's start it off. This all comes from essential research. I mean, this is Navy files that you were going through.
Yeah, it's the Navy, and before them, the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA. And this is, like you said, World War II. Now, this is the first time, a lot of soldiers who are ditching planes and ships going down,
right.
And they're, they're in the water.
South Pacific
Right. They're in tropical or temperate waters where there are more sharks. And there was a lot of shark hysteria, which is kind of amazing because I also thought of Jaws as being the place that started. But there was a lot of shark phobia, even though at the time all this was happening, no sailor had been killed by a shark. It wasn't a big problem.
It was a morale problem.
It was a morale thing. One wanted to fly. I mean, they're like, I will die for my country, but I will not be eaten by a shark. That I won't do. Forget it. No way. Not flying. So they're like, we need something. They called it a pink pill. Part of it was, let's just give them something to have, give them anything. But they also were like, well, maybe we can find something that works. So they got these guys who were... they're biologists, they're natural history guys, and they're like, we've got a big tank, we've got some sharks. They had a couple of big tanks, one at Woods Hole and one out on the that atoll where they tested the atomic bomb. So they've got these big tanks and a bunch of sharks, and they're just like throwing stuff in. They're like, let's try nicotine. Nah, that doesn't seem to work. Well, let's try, I don't know, let's
try
hot sauce.
So any sort of spray, lotion, anything like that,
just
right?
Just throw it in there. So they did some, there's some chemical compounds. It wasn't just sort of, what do we have in the hallway closet?
Right.
But they did test all of that. And basically... they found malic acid. There were a couple things where I think this is really, really going to work. One of them was decomposing shark meat.
But it was interesting in the story because it took a while. They took the chunks out of shark meat, and then they decomposed it, and then they brought it out there. And you're like, at the end of the day, even if that worked, the idea of putting that in pill form on a soldier who's going into the water is just not going to happen.
Yeah, a little cake of decomposed. I mean, it's like it was so surreal what they were doing.
Because the idea was the sharks didn't want to be around. Dead sharks.
Right. They'd gotten it from, because the guy, the main guy in this, Stuart Springer, I think it was, he'd worked in a shark, he's like a shark fisherman. Because nobody really knew much about sharks. And he's like, here's our expert. He's a shark fisherman. And there was this rumor that if you left your sharks on the line and they rotted, that area wasn't good to fish. So they figured something in that decomposed shark must be repelling.
Some chemical or something, right.
So they all got excited about that, and they head out to, the waters off Ecuador. And, these are natural history guys. They're like, expedition, let's go.
Let's go, right.
Yeah, we're going to be we need some funding.
Right.
So they're like off on the waters outside Ecuador, throwing stuff off the back of the boat, and nothing's working. First of all, they couldn't find sharks for like a week and a half.
So the story, as they continue to show this cause and effect, this trial and error to make it work or find a shark repellent, they kind of turned back to the idea of maybe we should do some research to see if this is really a thing, if our soldiers are actually being eaten by sharks.
Yeah, the Navy came in. The Navy's like, this is bogus. What do you guys, forget it. First of all, we're going to figure out, we're going to come at it a different way. I should step back. They did come up with a shark chaser, but what it was basically black dye. You kind of hide in a, like a squid.
Like a
you would be
or
a
or
human
octopus.
Squid.
Yeah, right.
You would hide in this cloud of black dye as long as it took for that to kind of dissolve into the water and then be useless. But it was, you know, it was the pink pill. It said shark chaser, and you'd be in your life raft. You're like, I got, there, I've got there, my shark chaser.
I guess the reason I jumped ahead is only because there was something said about the idea of getting a pill in your emergency case called shark chaser that was freaking out pilots more than the concept of the myth, right?
Yeah, exactly. So say you've made it to the life raft. You're like, here I am. I'll be okay. Phew, okay, I got nothing to worry. I got my water. I got a little bit of water. I got a little bit of food. I'm fine. And then all of a sudden you look down. There's this little packet and it says shark chaser. You're like, I forgot about sharks. So you basically planted this seed of fear in people who might not have been thinking about it. Although their claim was they're already worried about it.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Anyway. So, yeah. But then the Navy came in and said, let's actually study sharks. And let's see, is it true that blood attracts them? Does urine? Does sweat? And so again with the big tanks, throwing stuff in the water. And then they started looking at, what is it that attracts a shark to eat? And they found out that what it is a stressed out fish.
Right.
So they took what was called, and this is a scientific term, folks, distressed grouper water. Because you couldn't put the grouper in.
Because they wouldn't know.
Well, if you put the grouper in and it thrashed around because you were poking at it, which is how they distressed it, then the thrashing could be the thing that the shark was responding to.
So they need to almost make it stress the fish out and then
take the water that contains the stress compounds, put the water in the shark tank.
And then the shark goes crazy.
The shark goes crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the shark did. The shark distressed grouper water. Do not go scuba diving with a bottle of that.
If you ever see a sign anywhere in the ocean that says, warning, distressed grouper water here. don't go in, right?
Stay clear. Yeah, yeah, Steer clear. Yeah.
So they finally figured it out. They started to work around actual, science around stress.
Yeah, and they started this, and it still exists today, International Shark Attack File. They started looking at the actual reports and scuba divers, spearfishers in particular. And they realized if you're a spearfisher and you're doing well, you have a lot of bleeding, oozing fish, and you've sort of strung them on your belt, you are a neon sign to a shark, like, dinner.
Right.
We're open. Come over. So people were getting attacked because of the fish on the belt. It wasn't anything having to do with they were saying, the scuba suit. You look like a seal.
Right.
Maybe.
That's all been a little bit debunked.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the stress.
So it's distressed fish or just any kind of guts. And they did these amazing tests where they'd take, because they're like mammals. So sharks don't eat. They're not eating mammals. Maybe marine mammals, but they're not interested in that. And to prove it, they took a rat. And this is sad. They took a rat and they doused its fur with mullet blend, another scientific term.
Right.
It was like smeared, like worked it into the fur of the rat. They put the rat in the water with the mullet blend. The shark goes crazy, goes right for the rat. But without the mullet blend, it's just a little rodent swimming around. Doesn't care because that's not dinner.
They really, besides the shark chaser die, they just essentially did a marine biology study. I don't know if any of this stuff actually helped figuring out how to protect their soldiers.
You know what
or
the
their
best thing
sailors.
They did? The best thing that they did for the soldiers and sailors is they put this brochure, this little booklet called Shark Facts, I think it's called, and it's just basically saying the shark is a wuss. The shark, if you kick it, it goes away. None of this was done with great whites. And great whites, even if they come over and they're just curious, is this something that will taste good? One bite, you could bleed out. But even then, no shark normally wants to have you for dinner.
I think what's really interesting about it and where it plays in the context of your book is that the armed forces have for years used science at their disposal to be able to help. There have been good experiments and there have been bad. There have been ones that have worked and ones that have just been a long line of
But the Navy stuff was actually really interesting.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about urine or sweat. Now you know.
Now we all know.
Go ahead and pee in the ocean.
Navy, you're okay. You can be in the ocean.
But women menstruating, maybe not.
Yeah, right.
We won't go into that here, but
Well,
so anyway.
I mean, as we wrap up, I'm interested. There's so much to talk about. I mean, the one area that I thought was really interesting, and it's one that you can sort of relate to, is the idea of sleep deprivation or just sleep patterns when it comes to soldiers.
Yeah.
There have been a lot of experiments and tests and science to try and figure out how to make sure that a soldier can be up at night and, you know, sleep on a certain amount of sleep and be able to, wherever the war's at, be there at the time. That's something that the armed forces in our country have been working at for a long time.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, for a long time, they were just kind of looking at, like, wow, could we come up with a drug that would keep you up, but you wouldn't have any of the bad signs. I mean, like you would still be competent and you'd still be at 100% of your mental faculties. Well, no.
No.
They've gone back all the way. It's now caffeine. But what they're trying to do is minimize the, like you said, you may be flying from Guam to somewhere overseas and it's the jet lag. It's the fact that you may be arriving. Sometimes it works to your favor. If you're a special ops guy and you're flying from Guam somewhere and your night is day, well, primo,
right.
Because
you're good, yeah.
Your operation is at night anyway. So they've got glasses, depending if it's you want to block the UV, the sunlight, or you want to manufacture it artificially, depending on what time of day you want to set somebody's clock. You can kind of preset the person by they've got goggles with little blue light coming in that simulates sunlight. And then yellow to block it. So using a combination of those, you could sort of have your soldier preset to the time zone that you need them to be.
Well, I mean, and the other thing in the book is this concept that I didn't really think about. And that's what the book Grunt does for me. It's a lot of like epiphany moments where I'm like, oh, that makes sense. The concept that middle-aged to elderly men are making the sleep choices for 18-year-old soldiers.
Yes.
And the bodies don't work the same.
No, when you're in your teens and 20s, you are going to be wide awake till 12, 1, and you want to sleep till 10 or later. Mm-hmm. That's just how you're programmed. It's not because you're a lazy teenager. That's how you're programmed. You need more sleep and you need it. You're on a different phase setup. When you're older, it starts getting earlier and earlier and earlier. So you have these 60-year-old guys going, well, you know, I get sleepy at 9 o'clock and I'm up by 5. So what's the matter with that? Let's start basic training at 4:30 a.m. And it's brutal. And this one guy who was making this point, he's like, I took this general around and it was 11 o'clock at night, long after lights out. Everybody's up. They're just sort of lying in bed, like twiddling their thumbs.
I think at the end of the day, how much of this science, or at least the scientific experiments or studies that armed forces are doing for soldiers, how much do you think that it has an impact on everyday lives? The idea of all of us getting some sort of benefit from, you know, figuring out silk is the right fabric to protect, you know, like, I mean, the concepts. I mean, any of this stuff actually moving to the civilian side?
Tons of it, particularly in the medical side of it. I mean, in terms of vaccines, the military does a ton of work on vaccines. And also just things like this guy, this Navy captain, Phillips, was his last name. He figured out, okay, if somebody's got really bad cholera, where you got like you're squirting 5 gallons a day and you can die quickly. And he figured out, well, if you add sugar to the rehydration salts, you don't have to do it through an IV. It's so effective, people could drink it. So now you don't have to make your way to a clinic and hook yourself up to an IV. You just find somebody who can just drink this stuff down. So, and it can be out in the field. It doesn't have to be administered through an IV. I mean, that's huge. And it, you know, there's still 2.something million deaths from diarrhea in third world countries.
Yeah.
And a lot of it with children. So that's been huge. It's been a huge lifesaver. So there's emergency trauma care. You mean the advances that have been made and prosthetics, that kind of stuff, huge in terms of how it's impacted the civilian.
How forthcoming are the armed forces with this information? I mean, do they see it as do they classify it in a way that they're like, we don't want people to know about the uniform, the no zippers for the snipers. We don't want people to know about the advances we're making in medicine or shark repellent, whatever it is, because it has some benefit to an enemy?
All of the stuff in my book is not classified because I don't have clearance.
So right,
they told
right,
me.
Right,
you know,
right,
I did.
Right.
It's some things I was surprised at, like the camouflage facility, that's classified. They wouldn't let me in. They wouldn't talk to me. I'm like, really? Camouflage? Should I throw some colors, swirl them around. There you go.
Done. Yeah, right.
But that was classified. So for the most part, though, they are...
They're upfront.
Yeah. And they want to tell the story because they are upfront about it. And it's a positive thing that's come out of war when so much of what comes out of war is so god-awful. So they were actually happy to share those stories.
The book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. It is by author Mary Roach, who's also written books like Gulp and Stiff and Bonk and others. And she's using her curiosity to explore the science behind things like sex, space, the afterlife, human cadavers, now war. She's in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. Mary Roach, thanks so much. It's a pleasure having you here tonight. We appreciate it.
Oh, so great. Thank you so much, Justin.